Today's program is brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. It's a rainy day here in Brooklyn, and it is really nice and warm here in the studio, so I can't wait to get into it with a new buddy of mine from Washington, D.C., Adam Birnbach, bar director for pretty much every cocktail bar you could think of in D.C., as it turns out. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good.
Awesome. So I've hung out with you a couple times over the last 6 months down in D.C. at Two Birds, One Stone, mostly. But you're also the bar director for Estadio, amongst other places. I mean, you're a very busy guy there.
I have a bit going on, yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, like, I don't know how D.C. is. I mean, it seems a little more relaxed than New York, but I'm always just visiting there. I'm never working there. But I always say about New York, you know, it's not a vacation town, so it's good to keep busy. And you definitely seem to be subscribing to that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, yeah.
So what's your typical work day like?
Generally, I get into I live very close to Two Birds, One Stone. Mm-hmm. So normally I kind of just have that function as my base. And then I do most of my work there, and I jump over to one of the outlets, either simply going upstairs to the Southeast Asian restaurant, Doi Moi, or I'll go down the street to Estadio, or go to Chinatown for brew.
Yeah.
And just sort of pop in.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's kind of awesome that you have the cocktail lounge underneath the under Doi Moi. And like it kind of reminds me a lot of like the way my bars or the ones I run are set up here, where there's very close proximity. And I think if they were spread out anymore, there's no way I could do it, man. And you know, again, you know, I live in the neighborhood that I work in, and that's kind of not really a happy accident. You know, it's like I wanted to be close to work, and I've been, you know, there so long, and it just makes sense. But I think like you know, DC is such a cool kind of a unique kind of bar and restaurant scene. For what I've noticed, I've only been there a couple of times, but it is kind of tight that way. You know, it kind of seems like it's all in pretty much in like the closer proximity, like one kind of like a couple of different neighborhoods, you know, like on like 14th mm-hmm. Street, and like there's just like a lot of action in one place. And it kind of reminds me of like, you know, neighborhoods in New York where you can kind of, you know, like here you can go to PDT and Death & Company and Myowell and like all these great places, and you've only really covered like a few blocks on mm-hmm. foot, you know. And I think that's what's really cool about DC. I mean, like, you know, in the same way, like a lot of people don't drive there, you know, you can get around with public transportation or by bicycle or whatever. So it's, you actually can go out and like enjoy yourself without having to worry too much about being physically injured or worse, or you know, or anything that, you know, getting into illegal nonsense with, you know, driving, you know. So that's pretty cool. I like that about that town. How did you, like, first of all, you know, I'm kind of jumping ahead and kind of gushing about the neighborhood, but how did you actually get into bartending? Like, what led you to this? I mean, were you doing this like through school, or like was this something that just all of a sudden you're like, oh my god, I want to be a bartender, you know? Like, What led you to the point that, how did you get to where you are now, basically?
Well, I mostly grew up in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, which is a big resort area. So a lot of the jobs that you have are in and around food service and hospitality. So even when I was a kid, I worked in that kind of industry. And I just got to really enjoy the energy. And then when I moved down here to D.C., I was still in high school, and I got a job at a coffee roastery right by my high school.
Oh, cool.
As a roastery, yeah. And I learned how to taste through that. Because the big thing is, you know, after you finish roasting a batch, or actually all of your batches, you grind them up and you cup them.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of time, because it was my job, studying sort of the nuances of coffee. And through that, I got into, illicitly, I got into certain things like wine and beer and single malt scotch, which were sort of big at the time in the fancier wine and spirit shops are in the area.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of how I got into the spirits and cocktails through that.
So you basically...
It was definitely the energy of being in a bar and a restaurant that I really loved.
I totally agree with that. You know, it's crazy to me, though. Like, so that means you were actually, like, exercising and training your palate from a huge head start on a lot of us, you know? That's pretty incredible. I mean, I was drinking, like, I was working at a grocery store when I started drinking coffee, and I was, like, 15 or 16, and it was just, who knows, it was, like, some sort of, I think if it were freeze-dried Folgers crystals, that would have been, like, a good thing. There's no telling what they were putting in it, but it was definitely not a way to train my palate, too. It probably took years off of my training, as it turns out, later on. So that's cool. So you that's an incredibly hip job to have while you're in high school. By the way, you're working at a coffee roaster. I mean, I only envision that happening in like Portland, you know, like in high school working at a coffee roaster doing cuppings, you know, like that's crazy, dude.
Yeah, it was pretty rad.
Nice. So then you continued working in restaurants because you really enjoyed the vibe of it. I hear that. You know, there's a certain energy and buzz that happens when everything's like flowing really correctly and like everyone's having a great time. It's mm-hmm. really great. And, you know, and it's more, I find it to be like a little bit more challenging sometimes, or like even more rewarding to just play host, you know, and make sure that someone's having just the best time, you know. I always say that, like, the last thing you should think about as a bartender is making drinks, you know. You got to be, like, the guy who's, like, showing everyone a really good time. And the last thing, you know, that if, you know, you shouldn't be behind the bar if you don't know how to make drinks. I mean, so, like, it should come naturally, like, right there at the end. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, my God, this is a perfect experience. So that's cool that you get to experience all those things so at such a young age, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't really get to... don't really get to do that. So that's crazy. That's cool. So moving into wine and single malt scotches, were you, when you first started working with, spirits and wine and all, were you doing many cocktails? I mean, was it just straight whiskeys and wine pairings and stuff like that?
No, actually I wasn't doing much in the way of cocktails. Because even though I was tasting wine and tasting spirits, I didn't really drink in any real way. I was interested in the idea of fixing malt scotch, that sort of the distillation of a process of like someone made that or a group of people made that. It just completely fascinated me, and I didn't really get into the idea of mixing it until. Much, much later, because I would say, I mean, I was 17, 18 at the time when I first started kind of tasting this stuff. And then it wasn't until I'd been a bar manager at two places, and I became the bar manager at a very sort of forward-looking, I'm going to kind of choke on myself here when I say this, but a more kind of molecular gastronomy-tinged restaurant.
It's okay, buddy.
We all went through it, man.
Yeah, we did.
It was 2007. Crazy years. And, you know, doing things that involve, you know, sodium chloride and all that kind of jazz. Calcium chloride. That's when I kind of more heavily got into cocktails.
Yeah.
They were terrible, but that's when I started.
So you kind of went... So would you think, do you think that, like, you got into it with the more modern style cocktails and then kind of, like, worked your way back into the classics?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it was, it was kind of the understanding that what I was doing was real, real bad. this is my job. And I started getting into it a lot more, into the classics, and I went very heavily into the classics at that point, sort of as kind of an extra culture activity, because that wasn't really necessarily what was asked of me at the job. And I really, really enjoyed it. And that's how I truly got into cocktails.
So this is like 2007, 2008. This is when, you know, Hal's Alpens is starting to release, the Creme de Violette and Allspice mm-hmm. Dram, all these ingredients that we hadn't had access to. And a lot of people didn't even know what they were or that they ever existed, you know. So this is starting to hit the market. We started seeing a lot of, like, resurgence of, like, you know, well, first of all, the Creme de Violette ushered back in the aviation. But were mm-hmm. there, I guess with the molecular side, you were already kind of making your own syrups and doing, like, a lot of prep work, a lot of, like, maybe too many ingredients in one drink. but you're probably using some of the flavors and different, like, spices and stuff that ended up coming out later in some of these kind of more obscure liqueurs, right?
Yeah, no, it's in sort of a parallel way, that's very true. And I think that later on, when I kind of got back into the more, for lack of a word, culinary side, that having that those sort of parallel experiences definitely informed how I did it later on.
Yeah.
Totally.
Did you think that there was there's absolutely nothing wrong with molecular gastronomy or molecular mixology, but do you think that certain places like the Aviary in Chicago or, you know, any number of, like, West Coast cocktail bars, do you think that people are over it, or do you think it's just something that should be kind of, like, more special and it doesn't have to be everywhere? I mean, what's your take on that?
I mean, I don't think it's any better or worse than any other experience. I think it's a different experience, and mm-hmm. and there's a and obviously a place like Aviary is a very high quality. I mean,
sure,
DACs, very. I mean, these are, and I think they would. I think they themselves would probably take issue with that term, molecular gastronomy or molecular mixology. I think they're very forward looking places.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're exceptional in their way. It's just sort of, not to say that they're any more or less exceptional than a place that functions in a more classic way.
Yeah.
It's just different.
Yeah, sure. I totally agree with that. Over the last few years, I've been noticing that it's not like the molecular thing kind of, like, has initially died out. It's just, you don't see it so much anymore, but it's because I think people are being more responsible with it.
And
just in the same way that, you know, a lot of, like, what we think of as, like, West Coast style, like, you know, garden in a glass style cocktails,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's, like, one or two too many ingredients. I think a lot of times with the molecular mixology thing, there were one or two too many techniques that were being employed in one cocktail where, you know, like, if you, I don't know, I work this way a lot. Like, I'm really heavily into, you know, classics, but I like to mm-hmm. you know, throw a little twist in there. Like, I like to find an ingredient and then work it into a classic that makes sense, you know, or like some sort of variation on a classic, you know what I mean? But, like, not mm-hmm. I want to highlight that weird ingredient that makes it read well on a menu. You know, when I go to a cocktail bar or any bar really, and I look at the cocktail list, I'm always scanning. You know, there's only so many ways you can mix rye and brandy and Benedictine, you know? I mean, there are a lot of them, actually. But the thing is, I'm always looking for that weird, like, you know, Mexican Fernet or, you know, like, you know, some like, oddball thing that I'm like, all right, wait. Or, like, Pinot de Chirac, you know? Like, the Beagle used to have this Pinot de Chirac cocktail on, and it was a perfect example of it because it was basically like a sidecar-ish, if I remember correctly. But it had mm-hmm. Pinot de Chirac in it, and I was like, I freaking love Pinot de Chirac. I've never seen anyone use in a cocktail. And I had just gotten back from Cognac, so I was like, it was fresh on my mind, you know? And I was like, this is great. And, you know, it was just that one ingredient that was swapped out that made it jump out on the page. And I think just in the same way, like we were talking about, like just a second ago, about the tech, the techniques. You know, there's, you know, there are so many really amazing techniques you can use, and like molecular mixology. It's just, you don't have to do all of them for every cocktail. And I think that's what we've really seen over the past few years. It's like, all right, we're really excited because someone wrote a book about this, or like there were several books that came out, and I went to like Tales of the Cocktail and I saw like Dave Arnold doing this crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then we got like overly excited about it, you know, and we started trying to use it all the time. And I think, you know, like you have to be responsible with ingredients and with techniques, and you have to use them correctly. And I think that's kind of, I think it's all evened out now, you know, as far as like the way people are using like the molecular side.
Well, I think, I mean, and I don't think it's limited to molecular or culinary. I mean, I think if you look at,
I keep saying molecular, but
classical,
yeah,
bars too.
Yeah.
I think that the biggest development over the past few years has been, as a community, our ability to edit ourselves. I mean, obviously, people have been doing it exceptionally well for a long time, but I think overall, a lot of the cocktail bars that are existing now and are opening up just are very good at editing their drinks and editing their lists.
Mm-hmm.
That we're having really sort of clean, well-balanced, beautifully concepted cocktails.
Yeah, and more cohesive menus, as it turns out. Yeah, I would absolutely agree.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, there's got to be, in my opinion, with a really well-balanced cocktail menu, there has to be at least one banana cocktail on there, which we'll talk about when we get back from this break. Okay, Adam?
Oh, sounds fantastic.
All right, see you in a minute.
Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
And we are back. You are listening to The Speakeasy on heritageradionetwork.org or .com. It goes to the same place. So we are talking with Adam Birnbach out of D.C., the bar director for so many places. Doy Moy, Two Birds, One Stone, Estadio, Proof. And right before we went on the break, I threw out, you know, you were talking about well-balanced cocktails and well-balanced menus, but come on, let's get real. Banana cocktails. I mean, like you said to me the first time I met you, and it blew my mind, because you're like, yeah, I've got like two banana cocktails on the menu right now. And I was like, what? It's crazy. And it wasn't like a huge menu, but you said, you know, kind of quoting Arrested Development, there's always money in the banana cocktail. And that was the funniest thing I've ever heard. I agree. I think that's what, like, you said that like three sentences into us meeting, and I'm pretty sure we're bonded for life because of that. So tell me about your banana cocktail obsession, man.
Yeah, you know, I think it came as a little middle finger aspect to it. There's a lot of people that I know who just actively dislike or hate even the idea of banana or banana in anything. And I enjoy the idea of a challenge of making a banana cocktail that would be popular. that would be a highlight. And so I set out to do it, and I spent a lot of time on it. And I personally love banana, so it was not a challenge that I didn't hesitate with.
Yeah, I mean, while you were like doing like coffee cuppings in high school, I was driving around in my first car with like a giant bucket of banana Laffy Taffys in my past, like my, they were riding shotgun in my car.
Oh, yeah.
I used to just like eat banana Laffy Taffys and drive around and like read the jokes while I should have been focusing on paying attention to the road. But yeah, like the thing is, I guess with, I don't know, it depends. There's so many different ways to access the banana flavor. Some of them are very good and some of them are very artificial. But mm-hmm. I think anytime you do like a legit banana cocktail, you kind of have to do it. It's very DIY. There's like the Jaffard mm-hmm. banana Brazil, mm-hmm. but it's almost like it's got this like creme brulee thing going on, which is cool. In any kind of application where you're mixing it with different like spices and stuff, it works. But it doesn't work for everything, you know. Even though their liqueurs are pretty awesome.
Yeah,
but you know, but then you've got like, you know, like one of my bartenders, Garrett Richard. He does a banana liqueur that he takes, I believe it's El Dorado 3,
mm-hmm.
and infuse it with just like dried banana chips, and they puff out, and then like they infuse really very strongly, and then you get to eat the poofed out like rum soaked bananas. So that's pretty sweet. Or use them as a garnish. But yeah, so. I think that the banana flavor, even though to me banana is such a subtle, like it's a softer flavor, and it really is. It's not sharp. It's not acidic. It's not like huge, but for some reason, it's kind of like when you put, let's say, like I don't know. I'm kind of a hater on orange juice because like anytime you put orange juice in a cocktail, it just makes the whole thing taste like orange to me. You know, but banana, I think there's a lot more room to play with, you know, and especially, you know, like I said, using baking spices like the Banana Brazil stuff, or there's a banana cocktail on the ZZ's Clam Bar menu now that's, it's just called banana, and it has like banana infused tequila, it has like blue curacao, which is also an awesome ingredient, but it has like, there's this like dehydrated banana powder, like garnish. Like, there's so many elements of banana in this cocktail. It's awesome. But like, so, like, anyway, I kind of trailed off there for a second. But yeah, banana cocktails. You're the man with the banana cocktails. So, I think one of them was even a beer cocktail, right?
I'm sorry?
Do you have, I seem to recall there being a banana beer cocktail.
Yeah, one of them is the silver oat whiskey from High West, Amaro Nardini. It's Einger Brauweisse, the Hefeweizen, and a banana soda that we make.
That's awesome. You know, like to me, there's always that classic, like when you're drinking like a Weinstephaner or any kind of like old school like Hefeweizen. There's always that banana mm-hmm. flavor in there anyway, so it's so brilliant to just like roll with that, you know. And really highlight it. I love that.
Yeah, that, and I think the silver oat has kind of it has this weird sort of. I mean, it has a lot of tropical flavors, but the banana that's in it is sort of this very crystalline banana flavor. It borders on possibly artificialness, like a banana rind, mm-hmm. but it doesn't quite get there. And so yeah, it was. I definitely used that in the Hefeweizen to add. Two other banana notes to it, even if they weren't actually banana.
It's awesome, man. So, like, so let me ask you this. So, when mm-hmm. when you your process on putting together a cocktail, like from the moment of inspiration to the moment that you actually shake it, stir it, send it across the bar, what mm-hmm. what typically? How do you start your process? Do you start with an ingredient, or do you start with, for instance, I'll wake up sometimes, you know, I get a lot of my cocktail ideas like in my sleep, and I'll wake up and I had a dream about a cocktail that I was making, and I had like, you know, three ingredients that were mixed together, and it's like, all right, mm-hmm. one of them was kind of weird, and the other two were kind of like, kind of normal, but then mm-hmm. I'll go to the bar, like when I go into the bar that day, it's like, then I'll workshop it, you know, but, mm-hmm. But then sometimes like I'll start with just it, I find some weird ingredient, and it's like, all right. We're just going to go from there. Like, do you typically start with the ingredient? Do you start with like a classic spec, or like what's your process? Or does it, is it different for? I mean, it must be different for. It could be a really dumb question that I'm asking because I'm sure it comes in a lot of different styles, right?
It depends on where I am or what I'm doing it for. More often than not, it starts with a specific spirit that I really like and I really want to use. And there's some aspect of that spirit. And more often than not, there's multiple aspects of that spirit and kind of manifests itself in multiple cocktails that I want to highlight. You know, it could be the smokiness of a particularly peaty scotch. It could be the kind of the reedy funk of a rum agricole. It could be, I mean, Barolo Cannato is something that I just absolutely love.
Right.
And I love different Barolo Cannatos and to sort of display one that's more chamomile heavy, one that's more of a jarring sharp kind of quinine-ness. Anything like that. But sometimes, like for Stadio, that definitely when we opened that and the development of that menu, that changed a lot of things because I didn't have as much space for spirits, and I had to go a little bit more culinary, a little more DIY, and then it became using a lot more, Spanish culinary ingredients and how those can highlight spirits. Yeah. That sort of reversed the process.
Yeah, and, you know, Stadio is so good about actually doing really cool, like, big Spanish-style gin and tonics. You guys always have, like, the best gin and tonics. And, you know, to me, it's like, I always say that a gin and tonic should never be just gin and tonic, and you guys definitely abide by that rule, you know. The bar staff's always been really cool when I go in there. There's always some sort of weird, like, Amaro that I've never seen before, and I like to feel like I'm pretty on top of that game. But I think a lot of it's due to different distribution channels, maybe, and we just don't get it here. You've got some really cool stuff behind that bar, and the food,
thank you.
The food's great, and the cocktails are amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, just really, you're really crushing it, dude. You've got all the spots are amazing. It makes me want to go back to DC. In fact, I was supposed to go this week, and I had too many meetings and too much work to do, and it really bummed me out because I was hoping to come down and have gin and tonics, maybe a gin and tonic with banana in it even.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
So can you give us the contact information or the websites for the spots, or do you have like one parent one that you can check out all the places with?
So it's 2birds1stone dc.com, the number 2 and the number 1.
Okay.
It's proofdc.com.
Proofdc.com.
Mm-hmm. It's stadio-dc.com.
Threw in a curveball.
Yeah, I think there was, I'm trying to remember why that, if there's another Stadio DC or some reason. And then the last one is doimoydc.com. Cool. No hyphen.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. I love all the places. I definitely try to hit up as many of them as I can when I'm there. And hopefully next time I'll get to hang out with you again and enjoy some. I'm remembering we did have some Barolo Cannato cocktails when I was there last time. So you're basically all my favorite ingredients. You're using them, so that's pretty awesome.
I'm sorry.
I said you're basically using all my favorite ingredients. So I'm pretty psyched to come back down and see you. That's it for the show today, Adam. I'm really happy that we can make the time to get you on the radio. Hopefully we can get you up in the studio in New York City next time.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, cool, man. I'll see you soon, and thanks for being on the show today. Well, that's it for the Speakeasy this week. Tune in to heritageradionetwork.org for many programs like this one. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.